This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal fights for the health care rights of all prisoners of the state, and the radical Black tradition. Is the Black Left still alive and kicking? But first, the mayor of majority Black Flint, Michigan, declared a state of emergency last week after health officials discovered a toxic soup of pollutants in the city's water, including a high risk of lead poisoning. The health crisis was created when an appointed emergency financial manager forced Flint to switch from Detroit's water system to Flint River water. Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder has appointed emergency financial managers to dictate the affairs of virtually every majority Black city in the state, denying local populations control of their own institutions. In Detroit, water has been shut off to tens of thousands of poor people. We spoke with Thomas Stephens, a people's lawyer who's been active in the resistance to state and corporate takeovers in Michigan.
People are starting to rise up. The corporate media tried to stage celebration in Detroit last week. They had Governor Snyder on the stage, and they had to shut down the proceedings because people just weren't partaking it anymore.
The emergency financial manager who brought this terrible crisis, this water crisis, down on Flint, Michigan, is today the emergency financial manager for the Detroit public schools. So causing lead poisoning in children does not disallow an emergency financial manager from taking control of Detroit's school system.
Yeah, it's really incredible, isn't it? I mean, there was more than one emergency manager in Flint that signed off on this. There was Darnell Early is his name, as well as his predecessor. But yes, Early posted the switch to Flint River water together with the other Flint officials and presided over it. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when the water started coming out of the taps, brown and yellow, he was in charge. He was the person with the authority to do something about it and did nothing about it. And then just about the same time that the lead test results came out and this story became the sensation that it has become, everybody finally had to admit to what the people in Flint have been saying was true all along. He was reassigned to be the emergency manager of the Detroit public schools. And the other part of that is that before he was reassigned, Governor Snyder had admitted publicly that emergency management has not worked for the Detroit public schools. Of course, it depends on how you define the objective and what worked means. If this corporate so-called reform high-stakes testing, charterization operation is really intended to destroy public schools in communities like Detroit, as I believe it is, then I suppose it's been a big success, and that's why he's still in that office.
Now Flint is going to switch over to the Detroit water system, which has been providing good, clean water for much of the state for a very long time, but poor people in Detroit can't avail themselves of their own water.
Yeah, you know, again, an incredibly tangled tale, right? I mean, Flint, as well as all of southeastern Michigan, where the majority of Michigan's population lives, somewhere between 3.5 and 4 million people for the last few decades, has been receiving clean water and having all of their sewage treated by the Detroit system. In the bankruptcy, the Detroit bankruptcy run by the emergency manager, Kevin Moore, and his law firm, Jones Day, which he supposedly quit and then rejoined before the body was even cold, that system has been spun off to a regional, suburban-dominated Great Lakes Water Authority, which is supposed to be up and running starting January 1st, 2016. So the story goes on. And yes, the typical corporate media frame is that putting Flint back on the Detroit system is the solution. It is a good thing to do. Of course, it does not immediately clean out all the polluted water that's in the Flint pipes as a result of the mismanagement for the last year and a half. But that's somewhat misleading in the sense that the problems with affordability and access in Detroit leading to a public health crisis and the problems with lead and other contaminants in Flint leading to a public health crisis actually have the same root cause in terms of this power dynamic, this corporate domination, this treating water, a necessity of life, a necessity of everything in our communities, as if it were a widget or a car sold by General Motors or something, something to be dealt with, you know, pursuant to the corporate bottom line, as opposed to its real significance in our lives.
We see across the world examples of where technocracies are put in place to get away from troublesome democracies. And supposedly these technocratic governments will do what's right regardless of political partisanship. Well, if the emergency financial managers are an example of technocracy, well, what does that say?
You know, you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, as we see with the attempt to solve the problem of police race murder with body cameras, as we see in Greece and Italy and other places, the claim that there's some kind of technical solution to problems of class and race injustice, to the fundamental way that we decide to govern ourselves and share, you know, the spaces that we live in and the resources that are available and necessary for all of us, is not just a technical management solution, is it? And so when you have these EMFs, like our Governor Snyder, claiming to be neutral, objective, expert managers and imposing these kinds of crazy, totally unaccountable, unjust regimes, and this is the result you get. And, you know, many of us have been predicting it since Governor Snyder unveiled this in the spring of 2011. It's now become very true, and it's going to be really interesting. It's going to continue to be really interesting and really stressful and kind of horrifying to see it. I mean, when you see these kids and when you hear these kids who've, you know, been forced to drink this stuff while state officials who are responsible for public health said, oh, there's nothing to worry about. You know, those activists are just stirring people up. Like I said the other day, you know, pass the pitchforks.
And in fact, the poisoning of Flint, the bankrupting of Detroit, it appears these emergency financial manager regimes are a kind of economic and political martial law.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. And with a very carefully and elaborately designed legal and political and media and communications and psychological superstructure and framework to shove them through racial scapegoating and just pillaging the public resources that are necessary, getting at the most vulnerable people and just driving them aside or even in some cases apparently killing them.
Of course, a Republican statewide regime introduced these emergency financial managers, but with the acquiescence of lots of Democrats. And we see Democrats put forward as champions of the right to vote. But we don't see the National Democratic Party pointing to Michigan as a place where the vote is methodically denied to much of the black population.
No, it's really been awful, hasn't it? And indeed, in many ways, the pattern was not set in its full horrifying implications, but the path was paved by the previous Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm, for example, appointing an emergency financial manager to the Detroit Public Schools and really destroying public education in Detroit, making it totally non-viable under the very same rationales that, you know, we need to balance this budget, and this guy doesn't know anything. His name was Robert Bob, and he doesn't know anything about education, but, you know, I'm putting him in charge, and the elected school board is completely sidelined, and that was a disaster, and Snyder has just now doubled and tripled, and after the results of the Flint water crisis is apparently about to quadruple down on it, and yeah, neither the Democratic Party nor its historically powerful constituencies, talking about institutions like the unions, like the black church, like the whole working class panoply that we think of, you know, going back to the 30s and the New Deal, which was so instrumental in shaping the Detroit that we grew up in. None of them have taken effective action. It's been left to really a very small group of completely unfunded radicals to even speak out about it. Whether we're getting any traction at this point, we'll just have to see.
And that is quite interesting because Detroit was known as a radical black city, whether that reputation was deserved or not.
Well, and one of the guys who we lost in this fight, the great General Baker in the UAW and the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, was very well known for explaining patiently to people historically about how the Red Scare and the separation of a whole generation of leftists from the trade union movement, as he always put it, was this unknown historical factor that has shaped the politics of everything that came subsequently. And, you know, I think that has a lot to do with what we're seeing. There certainly should never have been the ability of Jones Day and Governor Snyder and the city government to go into that bankruptcy court in Detroit and to do what they did and to go into the Flint River and the water system and do what they're still doing without the imminent threat of mass unrest, right? That would make it too costly for them to do that. But because various individuals and small groups have been basically bought off by the crumbs from the table, they were able to do it, and they're still trying to do it.
People's lawyer Thomas Stephens, speaking from Detroit. On January 8th through the 10th, Philadelphia's Temple University will host a conference on the Black Radical Tradition. Keynote speakers include Angela Davis, Robin D.G. Kelly, Cornell West, Vijay Prashad, Anthony Montero, and Charlene Carruthers of Chicago's Black Youth Project 100. The title of the conference is Reclaiming Our Future, the Black Radical Tradition in Our Time. Larry Hamm, chairman of the Newark, New Jersey-based People's Organization for Progress, will take part in one of the conference panels. There has not been a mass movement in Black America for a very long time. We asked Larry Hamm if the Black Radical Tradition is more than just an academic subject.
I think there is a growing reservoir of discontent in the Black community that folks have tapped into. I think that in the Black community, there always has been a reservoir of anti-establishment feeling. The question has always been, can you get people to move from feeling discontent to actually voicing their discontent and then actively organizing and mobilizing around that discontent? Now, over the decades, I have seen this section of the population kind of ebb and flow. In the period right after the civil rights movement period called the Black Power Movement, a lot of that discontent was channeled into electoral politics. I mean, essentially, I think, although there were different strands in the Black Power Movement, different tendencies, different organizations that had different approaches, I think overall, when you said Black Power to someone, they thought of political power in the main, and that political power manifesting itself in the electoral arena. So a lot of that, you know, after the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Voting Rights Act and millions of Black people getting registered and voting for the first time, voting Black folks in office, that's where a lot of that discontent went. And what we saw, the fruit of the Black Power Movement, was a tenfold increase in Black elected officials, and you saw a waning in the street of the movement and the directing of the masses toward the ballot box. And for a period that went even in probably the 1980s, you saw a waning of the mass movement in the streets and an increase in this electoral activity. But then I would say somewhere around the mid to late 70s, many Black people began to discover that simply electing Black people to office was in fact not bringing about a major change in their material condition. Now, I think it's important to note that that's how some people felt. But on the other hand, there was a section of the Black community for whom some aspects of their material condition did change. For instance, many who would have gotten the opportunity to go to college were able to get to college, and as a result of that, they were able to get better jobs, so on and so forth. Even in the working class, Black people were able to avail themselves of more jobs in the auto industry and in government jobs. So for a section of the people, there was some improvement. But for the lower part of the working class, the underclass, the actual material conditions either didn't improve or in fact got worse. And so we saw this discontent begin to grow and grow and grow. And it has manifested itself at different times. More recently, in recent years, we have seen a lot of that discontent moved into mass action because of the issue of police brutality. Now, we have a new wave of anti-police brutality activity, but there has always been movement around the issue of police brutality. In fact, if we go all the way back to the 60s, almost every rebellion that occurred, and there were over 1,000 of them that occurred between 1960 and 1972, almost every one of them was triggered by either an act of police brutality or an act of racist violence, or in many cases, the two were the same. So there always was activity around the issue of police brutality at various times. That peak. And so now we're seeing this most recent wave with the Black Lives Matter movement, and we see a lot of young people who are alienated and disaffected, who are unemployed. Many of them have even gone to college and come home, not able to get jobs. They comprise a part of that reservoir of discontent and anti-establishment of feeling. Many black folks who have lost their homes due to the foreclosure crisis. Many more black people who lost their jobs due to the economic crisis, and on and on and on. So I think the reservoir of discontent is there. I think it has been tapped into by recent movements. I mean, we could go back to Jena 6. You know, I think the Jena 6 movement showed some of that discontent. And then, you know, all the movements that have followed that up to these anti-police brutality movements, which includes Black Lives Matter. So I think it's there. I think that the conference is needed, because we do need a theoretical perspective and a theoretical understanding of what is happening. And at the same time, those who are involved in the theoretical work need to hear from people who are involved in the practical work, the actual organizing on the ground, so that we can have a synthesis of the two and, in fact, raise all our consciousness to a higher level. So that's why I think this and other conferences like it are important. I mean, I'm mainly a street activist. I'm in no way even considered any kind of intellectual or theoretical worker, but I understand the value of that. I understand the value of having people who can really dissect this system and help us to understand how it's functioning and help us to understand how its processes are impacting our lives. And more importantly, help us to understand how we can fight against it more effectively. So I see value in conferences like the Black Radical Tradition. So I'm hoping that I will learn some things, and I'm hoping that I can maybe even bring a perspective that might offer a little value to some of the people that are there.
Oh, I think Larry Hamm and People's Organization for Progress are solidly and genuinely part of the Black Radical Tradition. Some would say that this black radical tendency or tradition is marked by a commitment to social transformation with an emphasis on black self-determination. What would you say?
I would agree with that. I think it's very important for us to understand what we mean when we say the black radical tradition. So let me say what I think, because I don't know that even among black radicals, there's often disagreement on how we see things. But when I think of the Black Radical Tradition, I think of those persons and movements who have not only been fighting for progressive reform, but who understand fundamentally that the big problems that face black people and other working and poor and oppressed people in this country really cannot be adequately solved until we fundamentally change our socioeconomic system. I think the Black Radical Tradition is about those people who have had a clear anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist view on these things, who understand, in fact, how the system of capitalism has created the very problems that we struggle against on a daily basis, and how the imperialist system, that expression of capitalism abroad, from the capitalist countries to the underdeveloped countries that they exploit abroad, how even that process of imperialist exploitation and domination is in fact connected to the system of oppression and exploitation right here in our own country. There are many people who fight on a daily basis and who fight the good fight, who fight for reforms that will help somebody. You know, I always keep in mind the saying, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. So some of these reforms do help a few people, and if it puts a few people back to work or keeps a few people from being homeless or keeps a few schools from closing, I say right on. But we don't just want to put a few people back to work. We want to eliminate unemployment and have a system that can provide jobs at a living wage for everyone. We don't just want to keep a few schools from closing. We want to keep all schools open and provide not just adequate, but provide quality education for all young people. We don't just want to be able to get a few homeless people off the street and put them into shelters. We want to eliminate homelessness and eliminate an economic system that in fact creates homelessness and poverty, and eliminate an international system. We don't just want to end wars. We want to end an international economic and political system, which many of us call imperialism, that in fact creates war, that in fact thrives off war, that in fact war is in fact its reason for being, you know. So that's what I think of when I think of the black radical tradition. I'm thinking of people who want to go to the root. As I understand the definition of the word radical means going to the root, to eliminate the root cause, not just eliminate the problems, which are very serious, but which are in fact manifestations of a problematic system that we live under.
Much of the black political ferment nowadays centers around the police. Do you see the seeds or evidence of a larger kind of black radical perspective emerging from the current incipient movement?
Absolutely. I think that there has been a significant leap in people's consciousness and thinking about the police that has occurred just over the last few years. I think part of that, of course, has to do with the technological advances that have allowed everyone now to, in fact, carry a telephone, which is also a video camera, in their pocket, and in fact film these police in the act of brutality and abuse and even murder, and get those videos out to folks. I think seeing that, it might be difficult for people to see it now, but I'm telling you, just 5 years ago, it was hard to convince some black people that there was police brutality, much less the white people. But I'm not talking about Uncle Tom's, and I'm not talking about establishment black folk that work for the government and work. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about every day. People would be surprised. You know, the masses are the masses. They're people. They're people who have all different kinds of thoughts. Yes, there is a general kind of opposition that the masses have to oppression, and that has a lot to do with their material condition, but you'd be surprised, even among black working people, how much of a conservative tendency exists on certain questions. And because black folk are so plagued by crime, because we live in poverty-stricken communities and live in situations where we have generations of folk living in poverty, there's a big concern about crime and violence and homicide. And you'd be surprised, some folks would be surprised at how much we have to struggle sometimes. You know, we'll be standing on the corner having a demonstration against police brutality, and somebody will walk by, and it ain't anybody working in City Hall. Somebody will walk by like, why are y'all demonstrating against the police? Why are y'all not out here demonstrating against the killing in our own community? You know, and when the Black Lives Matter slogan began to bubble up from people, then there was this counter reaction. Black people must love black lives. You know, why y'all just talk about Black Lives Matter when you talk about white police killing us? Why don't talk about the black on black killing? So these conditions that people face in their everyday lives cause folks to have certain kinds of ideas on things. And sometimes those ideas don't jive with our radical view and radical perspective on things and present real challenges to us in terms of organizing oppositional movements, and even more so, not just organizing oppositional movements, but organizing truly radical movements. Now, I do have to add this point, and that is I am buoyed by the fact that more than any time since I have been in college, and I left Princeton University in 1980, more than any other time since I left college, I have heard more real anti-capitalist sentiment than I have ever heard before. And of course, I'm hearing it in movement circles. I'm also hearing it more in academic circles. I go in and out of those circles because sometimes I'm asked to come and speak to students on college campuses, you know, about the work of the People's Organization for Progress. But I also hear it. You'd be surprised. I hear it going back and forth to work and sitting and talking with coworkers. There's really a more discussion going on now about capitalism. And there's really more anti-capitalist sentiment and anti-corporate sentiment. I'm talking about in the black community now, not just among the white community, white progressives. I'm hearing more anti-capitalist sentiment and anti-corporate sentiment than I've heard since I left Princeton University in 1980. My spirits are lifted by that in terms of the potential now for, you know, real radical movements to begin to take hold.
Black radicalism has been historically anything but quiet. It's been very contentious within the ranks of black radicals. Is that a good thing? And might we look forward to some of that in Philadelphia in January?
Oh, I'm sure. Contention has always been a characteristic of the left, because the left, even the black left, has various tendencies. One of the aspects I've noticed about trying to organize in the black community is that our people have been so oppressed and so exploited and so beaten down that when you're in a hole down far enough, 10 feet up might feel like progress. Now, you're not out of the hole, but 10 feet up might feel like progress. So black folks' lives are so difficult that some strategies for organizing, which would be rejected in some circles, still hold currency. Like the whole aspect, the whole belief that business can be a emancipatory strategy, the whole discussion that's going on now, and in a strange kind of way, I believe this thinking is manifest in the boycott movement. Now, I support boycott. You know, I think that the Montgomery bus boycott was a wonderful thing, and I believe in the weapon of boycotts, and POP right now, POP is in working with other groups, including the NAACP and New Jersey Citizen Action. We boycotted Panasonic because of the way they've been treating black women over there. So I support boycott. But when I listen to some of the discussions that go on in the black community, I think a lot of that discussion is buttressed by a belief in capitalism that somehow if black people develop enough black businesses, that will be a strategy for emancipation. Now, do I think black business is a good thing? I think that anyone who has the wherewithal to create a business that will make them self-sufficient, help them pay their bills and support their families and so on and so forth, I think that's a good thing. But will that be a strategy that can, in fact, liberate the masses of people? I don't think so.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. More than 100 supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal gathered outside a Scranton, Pennsylvania courtroom as a federal judge heard arguments about why state prison authorities should be forced to treat Mumia for hepatitis C. The nation's best-known political prisoner came close to death earlier this year from complications of the disease. Joe Piette is a member of Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He says Mumia isn't just fighting for himself.
No, it isn't. The state now says there's 8,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania that have Hep C. That compares, in the world, there's 170 million people globally. That's probably a low count, but that's official. In Philadelphia, there's 40,000 people with Hep C. Most people don't even know it because they don't know it until they start getting sick. And it's the same in prison. When they're in prison, people are tested routinely for HIV, but they're not tested for Hep C, so that they go back to the community once they get out of prison. And it just spreads throughout the community once they're back home.
It becomes kind of clear that the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania doesn't test for hepatitis C because it's not going to cure anybody of hepatitis C.
Exactly. If they tested and found out for sure, then they, like with Mumia, then they have the pressure to treat the person. And that's what the case is about. Once the tests show that he's got Hep C, then the state is obligated as a human right to cure him. This new medicine can cure 90 to 95% of people with the disease.
So what is the state saying in its own defense for its failure to treat one of the inmates under its care, or many thousands, in fact, of the inmates under its care, for a life-threatening disease that is treatable?
They're saying that they're not going to treat him until he's sick. In other words, they're saying he's not sick enough, so they're not going to treat him. And of course, when the illness is that bad, that you must be treated. It's near the end of the cycle. It'd be too late to really save him. The quote they use is, until the final stages of the condition. Well, there's no reason why a person or a prisoner needs to get to the final stages of the condition until they're treated. In fact, over the last 6 months, more and more agencies are recommending that anyone who has Hep C should immediately be treated with this new medicine. Harvoni cures up to 95% of people. No one should have to get sick when it's preventable.
Yes, and in fact, this amounts to a state imposition of a death sentence on Mumia and his similarly afflicted comrades in jail, because if they were not in jail, they could be treated. But since they are in jail, even if monies were raised, they cannot be treated without the jail's permission, the prison's permission.
Exactly. The money's there. Even though the medicine is expensive, up to $95,000, for Mumia, the money can be found to treat him. Of course, for all the other prisoners, the 8,000 other prisoners in Pennsylvania, the question is, what about them? And in fact, if the judge rules in the favor of Mumia, that will be a precedent that the other prisoners also need to have this medicine.
And the state's complicity in this is multiplied by the probability that Mumia got hepatitis C from a transfusion that was the result of him being shot by police 34 years ago.
That's exactly right. When they shot him, they gave him a transfusion, and they stepped on the cord that went to his bed for removing urine. They stepped on it for I don't know how long. They, of course, when they arrested him, they beat him up pretty badly, even though he had been shot and was totally, he couldn't fight back or anything. He was shot. But that didn't prevent them from continuing to torture him with blows to the head and body.
And the transfusion contained the hepatitis C virus.
Exactly. Back then, they didn't test for hep C.
If Mumia wins, will this set any kind of precedent?
Yes, we believe it will, not only in Pennsylvania, but in other states as well, who also, a number of states, there are also prisoner lawsuits demanding this medicine.
And as with other events in Mumia's long journey in the U.S. prison system, he's gotten support from outside of the country as well.
Yes, and in fact, December 15th, last week, the French Solidarity Group there were able to gather the signatures of over 108 European Parliament members and French Senate members, and they put their names on a letter to the governor of Pennsylvania requesting that Mumia be treated for hep C, that he should, as a human right, be given this medicine.
And yet I've seen no such petition from the Congressional Black Caucus in the United States.
No, they haven't. Even though the Congressional Black Caucus made a study of hep C and came out with some figures on the number of people in the United States from the black community who have hep C. So the Congressional Black Caucus is aware of the seriousness of this epidemic in the community. But even though several members of that caucus have been asked to come out and make a statement for Mumia, up to this date, no one has been willing or has had the courage to come out for him.
That was Joe Piet of Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. New York-based writer and political analyst Eric Dreitzer recently returns from a fact-finding trip to Venezuela, where the Socialist Party, founded by the late Hugo Chavez, lost badly to the right-wing opposition in legislative elections. The opposition won two-thirds of the seats in the national legislature. Dreitzer's latest article on Venezuela is titled, "The Revolution That Will Not Die." Although the socialist project in Venezuela is not yet dead, Dreitzer agrees that it has suffered a major setback.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, obviously an electoral defeat, especially one as significant and clear as the one handed to the PSUV, the Socialist Party of Venezuela, obviously indicates quite a lot. It's obviously a defeat. It's obviously a setback. But I also think it indicates the effectiveness of the campaign against Venezuela, against the Bolivarian Revolution. You know, being inside that country really illustrated, it highlighted, it brought to life a lot of the points that I may have known on an intellectual level, but once you experience them, you start to see it. For instance, I give an example, the lack of basic consumer commodities on the shelves in the country. The Western media, the corporate press, tries to say that this is merely an example of the failed economic policies of the Bolivarian government. But the reality is that this was a deliberately constructed scarcity, an artificially manufactured scarcity for the purposes of psychological war against the people of Venezuela, to force them to identify the problems in their own lives with the government and thereby to vote against them. And we see this proven time and time again. We've seen it just this week. After the right-wing, pro-U.S., neoliberal opposition won the election, all of a sudden, magically, these items begin returning to the store shelves. And when I say staple items, I mean things like deodorant, sunscreen, toilet paper, shaving cream, things like that that regular people need in their lives that were missing. You saw lines, that people standing in lines for hours at a time to get basic staple goods. Now, is this solely because of an economic crisis in the country? I would argue no. There is documented evidence of the privately owned distribution networks that are still controlled by the wealthy capitalist class in that country that have deliberately created scarcity, selling their items abroad rather than selling them in the country for domestic consumption. Many examples just like that, including the country's largest chicken processing plant, closing down operations but continuing to pay its workers not to produce, thereby creating a scarcity of chicken in the country. And so you see this over and over again playing out, and it's something that you have to be in Venezuela to really understand the impact of it. It was precisely those types of material issues that drove many voters who would normally have voted for the left to vote for the opposition in that country.
In your first article, you interviewed a Venezuelan who said he thought things would get better if the government was voted out, because then the United States would let up off of Venezuela. In other words, he understood that the shortages were induced by outside forces and not by the government, but would rather have a government that the United States was not always trying to undermine and thereby messing with the availability of goods.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's interesting to note that that individual, he was a taxi driver, he was actually anti-Chavista. He was not in favor of Chavez, not in favor of the Bolivarian government, actually a supporter of the opposition. But when I pushed him and questioning him and talking to him in detail, it became clear that even somebody who was as stridently anti-leftist, pro-right wing as this gentleman was, even he understood that a lot of these issues were a direct result of the U.S. subversion of Venezuela's economy. And this is really a critical point, because to a large extent, these issues were very much in play when Chavez was president of the country. But of course, as I think most listeners would know, when Chavez was in charge of Venezuela, oil was at about $130 a barrel or more. Now it's dropped to below $35 a barrel. We're talking about a country whose revenue stream is about 95% dependent upon oil revenue. And so Venezuela is not really able to get over a lot of the economic subversion that they once did when they were able to substitute it with oil revenue. So this is really part of the problem here, is there's an international campaign of economic destabilization, economic war waged against Venezuela, while at the same time, or against the backdrop of the global collapse of oil prices. This has obviously exacerbated the economic struggles of the country, and I think it, to a large extent, this is what drove so many former Chavista supporters to back the opposition. Now, I think we should also point out, and this is something I've mentioned in numerous writings here, that no matter what we say about the results of this election, one thing is clear. At least 40% of the electorate came out in support of the Socialist Party, in support of the Bolivarian government. That means more than 5 million people in Venezuela voted for socialism, voted for anti-imperialism, and did so against the backdrop of one of the worst economic crises in Latin America. That, I think, illustrates the level of commitment that a wide swath of the country still feels for the ideals of this revolution. It's part of the reason why, despite all of the setbacks, despite all of the conflicts, I'm confident that the Bolivarian Revolution will continue, it will expand, it will deepen, and its nature will change. And I think that this is an important subject that a lot of people are really not paying attention to. What this election means for the future of the Bolivarian movement, the future of the revolution in Venezuela, I don't think this is the end, not by a long shot.
Hugo Chavez's successor, President Maduro, is now scrambling to make permanent those socialist programs that might be endangered by the two-thirds majority that the opposition won.
That's right. We can speak about that in the abstract, but I think that really looking at the very material issues is really important here. Maduro is moving to make permanent the workers' law. This is a law that enshrines, it codifies the protections of workers, including pensions, including weekly hours of work, and many other issues. It codifies them into law. It prevents the wealthy capitalists from exploiting labor the way that they did in previous governments under previous previous administrations, that law is now under attack by the right wing when they've already stated publicly that in the National Assembly they will move to repeal that law. They will move to undermine and possibly also repeal parts of the Bolivarian Constitution put in place in 1999. That Constitution is absolutely critical. It's a cornerstone of the entire Bolivarian process. And I can tell you, in speaking to many people on the streets in Venezuela, there is a clear consensus, even among people who turned out to vote for the opposition, that if the opposition moves against the Constitution, if they move to repeal some of the basic rights enshrined in that Constitution, that there will be clashes in the streets, that millions of Venezuelans will turn out to defend that Constitution, which is clearly the most progressive Constitution in Latin America, perhaps anywhere in the world. And so this is a really critical moment here, because January 5th is when that two-thirds majority of the right-wing representatives takes their seats in the National Assembly. They've talked about everything from closing down the tomb of Hugo Chavez and moving him to a regular cemetery. That caused an uproar in the local media when that was stated by opposition politicians. They've talked about moving against the Constitution, a number of other really unpopular moves that the opposition has already said they're going to be pushing, because, of course, these are the moves that are dictated to them by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and by their patrons in Washington. Ultimately, that's what this comes down to. The two-thirds of the National Assembly being part of the opposition means that the National Assembly is directly controlled by the United States and the ruling class. That is what that means. Most people in Venezuela that I spoke to understand that perfectly, and they're moving very quickly to prevent against any move against their progress.
A criticism from the left has long been, also when Hugo Chavez was alive, that these capitalists should not have been allowed to continue in such commanding positions in the media over the economy so that they could induce these shortages, and that the revolution should have been firmer and faster, picked up the pace while it had overwhelming public support.
Well, there's no doubt that criticism's been made, and there's certainly a tremendous amount of validity to it. However, I think we also understand, especially people who have studied revolutionary theory to any extent, that each revolution, each revolutionary situation is dictated by certain circumstances. And I think that in Chavez's opinion, especially when he first came to office in late 1998, early 1999, Chavez's position was that the Bolivarian process, the revolution that he was hoping to build, could take place in a purely democratic fashion, that is to say, through electoral means. And he was of the belief that a Castro-style, Cuba-style revolution could not happen in the 21st century of Latin America, given the political circumstances, given the nature of the global economy and Venezuela's position in it, that essentially it would be dangerous for the country to try to expropriate all of the private capitalists all at once. Now, whether or not Chavez was correct or incorrect, I think that that remains the subject of debate. But ultimately, the building of the revolutionary process was begun, it was initiated, and Chavez really saw it as a process. And moving against these private interests, moving against the capitalist class, this was ultimately always part of the larger program. It just wasn't at the beginning of that program. And unfortunately, I think that we can, looking back on it, that may be one of Chavez's mistakes. I suppose it's a matter of debate.
Well, there must be a great debate going on right now in the Socialist Party of Venezuela.
Oh, there's no doubt. I think that there's a lot of soul-searching. I think there's a lot of self-criticism. Maduro, President Maduro himself, when he was on camera before the nation, really said as much. He said that he and the party took responsibility for the loss and that they would need to reflect on their policies, on their conduct, in order to win back the support of all of those Venezuelans they've lost. And I think that he's made moves to that effect to really demonstrate that the party is being responsive to the voice of the people. For instance, within 48 hours of the election, Maduro called for the resignation of all of his cabinet, all of his ministers. He moved for a quick and thorough reshuffling of the entire government, that is to say, of the executive branch. And I think that that alone was a move that was widely regarded, widely hailed as important, as productive, and probably also long overdue. And I think that also, you know, Maduro has shown his street credentials, and this is important as well. Just a few days after the election, Maduro was leading a march, a demonstration in Caracas, demonstrating for people that this movement is not dead, it is going to continue, and it is going to deepen. Now, the reason I bring that up and the reason why that's important is not simply because it was a demonstration. It was because it is a symbolic gesture, a symbolic move on the part of the government, recognizing that the Bolivarian Revolution is really run by people power. And that is one thing that people oftentimes overlook, that the revolution is not in the hands of the Socialist Party. The revolution is in the hands of working people and poor people of Venezuela. I visited multiple communes. I visited working class and poor neighborhoods. This was a theme that came up over and over and over again, that no matter what happens in the elections, no matter what the government is, no matter what their policies are, that the movement is always going forward. The communes are developing. The independent infrastructure of people power is developing. We saw just the other day Diosdado Cabello of the government meeting with the communal councils, meeting with the worker organizations, all of these things at the grassroots level, these are happening, these institutions are developing further, and they're doing so more rapidly, knowing that starting January 5th, in the National Assembly, there's going to be a huge movement to roll back all of the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. That cannot be allowed, and the people of Venezuela are mobilizing to prevent it.
Some of those gains of the Bolivarian Revolution are also gains for its neighbors who got good deals on oil. Will those continue under the new legislature?
Well, that's a very pointed concern because, of course, the right-wing opposition, the so-called Unity Roundtable, the MUD, they have already said that they want to eliminate or at the very least roll back the Petrocaribe program, which was put in place by Chavez and the government as basically a way for Venezuela to bring up its neighbors in Latin America and in the Caribbean with cheap energy. That program may be rolled back. It depends how well they're able to do that, how well they're able to sell that to their base. But you have to understand something, and this is a really fundamental point, that almost everyone, with the exception of one or two people that I spoke with in my time in Venezuela, almost everyone who voted for the opposition said the same thing to me, that their vote was not a vote in favor of the pro-U.S. neoliberal opposition. It was a vote against the current government. And that's, I think, a critical point for people to understand. This was how they voiced their displeasure with the current state of affairs, not the voicing of a transformation on ideological or political grounds. The people of Venezuela are still largely committed to socialism, largely committed to the principles and tenets of anti-imperialism, and they see their place in the world as unchanged from the time of Hugo Chavez to now, that the election results really indicate the effectiveness of an economic crisis, and those right-wing legislators now, if they think that they have a mandate to roll back all of these gains, they are absolutely overplaying their hand, and if they do so, it may cost them their careers or more, because I can tell you the people of Venezuela are prepared to defend their revolution even with their blood if they have to. That is what multiple people told me when I spoke to them. They are prepared for anything up to and including a U.S. intervention against their country. So this is really what's at issue. There's a lot at stake in the coming weeks. If this neoliberal government tries to do things like privatize the public media, what public media they have, if they move to privatize what the government has nationalized, if they move to roll back all of these gains, they will be met by millions in the streets. That is a fact, And there are people and countries in Latin America who will stand in solidarity with Venezuela. There would be no Evo Morales in Bolivia if there were no Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. There would be no Rafael Correa in Ecuador had there been no Hugo Chavez. There are multiple countries that are looking around Latin America. They see a right-wing shift in Argentina. They see a right-wing element in full force against the government of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. And they see the right-wing in ascendance in Venezuela. There is a critical moment coming for Latin America, and that moment is once again a moment of resistance against the imperial system, against the United States, against the empire.
And what about the dependability of the military?
From everyone I spoke to, no one there believes that the military is going to buckle under this pressure. The military traditionally backed the Bolivarian government because of their, of course, personal loyalty to Hugo Chavez, because of their loyalty to what Chavez meant and to Chavez's legacy. And from all indications, now the military is still firmly in that camp. Now, certainly, I think if we're looking at it objectively and with an eye to history, the United States and its proxies have done always a marvelous job buying off high-ranking military officials, trying to fracture the military establishment in every country that it targets for demonization, destabilization, and intervention. So I think that on the one hand, we, of course, have to be on guard for any potential fractures and divides within the military. But from those people in the know that I spoke with, I think the military is considered the most reliable organ of the government's power, much more reliable than the National Guard, the police, much more reliable than certain other institutions in the country. And so again, this is why I return to this point that if the right wing believes that they have a mandate to push all of these U.S.-backed neoliberal policies, they will be met with force in the streets from the people. And if they move against the people will have the army behind them. That's why the situation is critical. The country is divided, and it is a matter of policy, and it is a matter of politics, how this is all going to evolve from here.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.